Welcome to the talk. You're here for the students, young workers, and capitalism. How can we get the future that we want? So I have my following panel members. I have Laura Martinez, Taylor Mahit, and Adam Hudson. So general rules are they're going to speak for a little while, then afterwards we're going to have a question time, so you guys can raise your hand, or if you have a question, just do a little hook. I'm going to limit people's comments and questions to 2 minutes, so we can make sure that everyone who has something to say, gets a chance to say so. If you're running a bit long, I'm going to say 30 seconds, and after that, I'm going to say wrap up. Please, when I say wrap up, because, there's lots of folks here, and we just want to make sure that everyone has a say. Mm-hmm. So without further ado, we're going to get started. So who wants to go first?
Laura, I just recently graduated from Mount Sinai Community College, and I'm actually in the process of transferring to Cal State LA. I'm here to talk to you about the student group in Mount SAC called the Students for Immigrant Rights of Internationalist Current. Some of the things that we do in Students for Immigrant Rights is we fight against all the attacks on the immigrant community. And right now, one major issue that we have that's happening in the local area in Pomona, California, is police checkpoints. As most of you might know, immigrants right now are not allowed to have any licenses. So, when we get caught up in checkpoints, we end up fined for very large amounts of money. The amount or the fine is about $1,000, and then plus, your car being impounded and all the fees you have to pay, and it all really roughly estimates to about like $1,500 that you have to pay just for, pulling into a checkpoint. Your car gets impounded for 30 days, and so mostly these checkpoints are covered up as like DUI checkpoints, And when you look at the statistics about like how many people are actually drunk when they pull into a checkpoint and how many people lose their cars for not having licenses, it's like about out of 200 cars, like 3 people are actually drunk and the rest are like either undocumented or don't have a license for some reason. So then you really begin to question the reasons why these people are actually having the checkpoints, and then the areas that they're having checkpoints are. Like in the poorest areas of Pomona, mostly where the immigrant community lives and where there's much more undocumented families that don't have licenses. So, it really makes you question, like, why are they doing these checkpoints? And, it's pretty much, it's very obvious that they're doing this for profit. Another thing about the checkpoints is that we've learned in also trying to fight the checkpoints is that this is like a violation of the Fourth Amendment. As we know, we shouldn't be pulled over for without a probable cause, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're pulling people over and just taking their cars away. Among other things that Students for Immigrant Rights have done is we have organized actions. For instance, in an occasion in Mount SAC, we had two people in a panel in a debate trying to legitimize, anti-immigrant propaganda, and it was all very racist. So what we Students for Immigrant Rights did is that we actually protested them and wouldn't let them speak, and we were very, very destructive, and we were able to get them out. Other things that we have done is that we have held lawyer rights forums where we have had lawyers come and either speak to people about, giving them legal advice letting people know like the state of the movement and stuff like that, and what can we do to actually obtain what we want as immigrants. We have also organized marches on campus in which, we had a very, very large amount of students participate. I would say maybe it was like roughly between 90 students that participated in the march, and it was very, very interesting. We had a few speakers, and a lot of students were able to engage in that march. We have helped build for marches in LA, which we are also part of like this coalition called the Southern California Immigration Coalition, And we, as Students for Human Rights, we've been very active in this coalition, and we were able to take off the show, you know, Homeland Security, when we protested in front of the ABC office or main building. But we, as students, again, Students for Human Rights, what our main goal is pretty much to obtain amnesty, you know, and that's one of our main arguments that we make, is that, you know, we need an amnesty and whatnot. And so often, because we use the word amnesty, you know, we get a lot of problems and we get a lot of questions like, you know, why not just fight for the Dream Act? You guys, you know, students, undocumented, fight for the Dream Act. But when you look at the Dream Act and actually like analyze it, you know, you see the details, and it's very, very iffy if you kind of think about it, right? First of all, you know, in order to even qualify for the Dream Act, which most AB 540 students would qualify for, AB 540 meaning is a bill that was passed, I believe, in 2003. And what it does is that it allows undocumented students that have been attending high school for 3 or more years in the states of California, I believe Utah and Texas, to go to college and pay regular tuition fee. Regular tuition and be able to, you know, just go to school. And, you know, that's not really a lot of immigrant students that come here, you know, at an older age, let's say after age 16, and which is that actually they put it in the Dream Act, and you, in order to qualify for the Dream Act, you have to be between the ages of 16 and 35. And you have to have a high school diploma or an AA degree in order to actually obtain a conditional status. And to top it off, that's only going to give you a conditional status. So to top it off, you have to have a good standing in a bachelor's degree or higher, or you have to serve the military for 2 years. So when you look at those details and see like the amount of resources that are being put into students going to school and even graduating from high school or college, you know, most of our people don't actually even make it through high school. So how are we supposed to make it through college? And considering that most college students have to work to pay themselves through college with minimum wage, how are we supposed to make it, right? And so, you know, the Dream Act does mention that some education assistance will be provided, which include like student loans and also like a federal work study program and you know, student loans. How many students have gone through student loans and end up in debt for like the rest of their lives? And then there's, you know, the study work education, the study programs, which include like community service and whatnot. I mean, is that the way you pay for your college, or is that, you know, will you be being paid in these work study programs? It's really, really unclear what these work study programs are to begin with. And if we think about it, you know, shouldn't like education be free if, you know, anyway. So you know, it just seems like the military aspect of the Dream Act is what's really gonna be more successful in this whole scenario, because we not enough resources are being put into helping us graduate, and not enough resources are being put into our education system, period. So it's going to be much easier for someone to say, I think I'm better off going to the military in order for me to obtain what I need, right? So it just seems like it's just another scheme. And, it's important to see like other alternatives that we have in order to obtain what we need, right? So for this is where like socialist politics have helped us understand what's the next step of the movement and what is it that we can do. And when we look at past movements and apply those strategies to the movements of the immigrant rights movement today, we can probably learn something from those things, and we can actually, you know. For instance, like in the 60s, for example, like in order to demand an end to segregation, there was mass movements taking place, which included protests, marches, walkouts, sit-ins, and boycotts. The same was being done to end the war in Vietnam, And we used the same strategy in 2006 on May Day to defeat H.R. 4437. With thousands of people marching in Chicago and Los Angeles, etc., we were able to defeat that bill and, you know, ultimately get rid of it, and nobody really considered it anymore. So it's just examples like these that we need in order to really obtain what we need. So so I'm just going to wrap it up because I have much time left. But I just want to say that it's important to apply those strategies from the past and apply them to today's movement in order to really obtain what we need, and we just all have to remember that we are the ones that make the change, not anybody else. Thank you.
Okay, up next we have Taylor McKee from San Francisco State University.
Working as a part of the Campus Anti-War Network and SF State's branch is called Students Against War. And for those of you who maybe are not familiar with CAN, it's one of the largest student-based grassroots organization against building an anti-war movement. And our points of unity as stands right now are the immediate and full withdrawal of all troops and mercenary soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan, reparations for the people of those countries, and full medical benefits to all soldiers returning regardless of discharge status. Yeah. So I want to begin by discussing my experiences just in the past year with CAN, and I've been working with CAN for like a year and a half now. And at SF State, we began with a focus on the occupation in Iraq, and we started producing literature and public meetings to express the focus on immediate withdrawal. We saw timid but consistent growth in the first semester with really quality members coming into us, and we held regular public meetings and tabling. And then in October, CAN met in Chicago for its national conference, and all of the chapters coalesced. And after a weekend of engaging conversations and sessions, the voting bodies present made several changes that are significant to the new political situation that we were about to enter. In addition to our original points of unity, which only included Iraq, we added Afghanistan. And while a point of Palestinian solidarity was not reached as a point of unity, we did add it as a resolution that's going to be addressed within the next year. And shifts in imperialist policy that we were about to see were and must be reflected in our activism. And we would see that the necessity for political flexibility and relevance in the next few months. November would bring the election of President Obama. December and January saw the brutal attacks on Gaza. And throughout the winter, increasingly dramatic failure of our economy was impossible to ignore. And so with these rapid changes in political climate, we entered the second semester a little bit disoriented. The attacks on Gaza warranted immediate and severe actions from each CAN chapter. Universities in the UK, followed by CAN chapters on the East Coast, began acting in boycott, divestment, sanctions campaigns, and many of them winning demands and forcing the university to take a stand against Israel's apartheid. With the excitement of these direct actions bringing about a tangible change, our chapter at State was eager to begin boycott, divestment. But we found that focusing on only one current goal and not all the aspects of organizing, such as base building, tabling, education for all of our new members, left us scrounging for enough hands to work on the projects we had. In addition, the increasing threats and punishments of budget cuts were felt at SFSU and shadowed a lot of what CAN was trying to do. And this is not to mention that under the Obama administration, war efforts have been transformed in rhetoric. We needed time as an anti-war organization to transform ours as well. Committed and consistent dedication is needed in any struggle, but without a holistic approach that works on both relevant political goals and the basics of any organization, winning that struggle becomes impossible. Given these lessons from the last year of organizing, though, I can see several prospects for which a student movement could be built. The first should be most obvious to any student who received an email like I did about 2 days ago. Classes in the fall have been cut, but the new schedule isn't ready, and registration is going to be postponed another month, but my fees are still due in 3 days, and I can't see the dismal amount of classes that I'm going to be able to register for. Yeah. And this is not to mention that in California, IOUs will soon be distributed to the disabled, elderly, and students who would normally be receiving state aid. Each and every student is going to feel the pressure of these budget cuts, and this is an opportunity for campuses to be transformed. And it's easy to build solidarity among students when their options are becoming so limited. This is a crisis in education, and it's important for a dedicated force of student activists to begin mobilizing our campuses and fighting for our right to education. And the next exciting prospect that should be continued is an effort for boycott, divestment, sanctions where it's appropriate. And though Netanyahu has accepted there's a need for a Palestinian state, we should remain critical of what this kind of state would look like. Less Palestinians and grossly unequal resources to that of Israel. Many universities need to dismantle their ties to this kind of injustice. The university is an institution that stands for the expansion of ideas, growth of knowledge, and of the mind. This same university we must demand should not be forcing its students into abject poverty before they enter the real world and supporting war profiteers at the same time. The role of the university in a larger movement is to bring the creative thinking and expression. It is necessary for each student and activist alike to comprehend the vast purpose that it can serve in a social movement. And lastly, as focus has shifted in the Obama administration, so must the anti-war movement. This should not be difficult because the Obama administration has moved quickly to escalate the war in Afghanistan while changing the terms in which it's been discussed. Though we are no longer working under the Bush administration's war on terror, we must understand that the strategies of war have not changed. This occupation has been getting more brutal, more gruesome, and thus the efforts of activists must increase. And with Afghanistan, it's important to stress the history and the roots of American imperialism. It's important for us to explain the history that we've created there and the problems that are exacerbated by our own action. And without explaining this history and responsible journalism within the media, it's more difficult to win people over to an anti-war argument. This is going to be the next front for the anti-war movement. So understanding the past is the only way to make that kind of an argument that will change a mind and add an activist to our allies. And as for the future, what is it that we want? And for me personally, I could see that I would want many things. I would want a successful, organized, clear, and holistic movement to bring an end to U.S. occupation and the aid to other imperialist occupations. I would love to see free and quality education for all, and I think we all agree on that. I'd like to see a society driven not by profit and capital, but by the needs of humans. Better care for people, not just citizens. We are all humans and deserve quality health care, access to public services, and acceptance into a nation. For example, here in San Francisco, muni fees have just increased and will do so again in about 6 months. Imagine if the transportation that workers and students in the city relied on did not eat into their paycheck, but was provided for as a service. And above all, my daydreams and fantasies about the future, I want a motivated youth that would be diligent in creating and sustaining this kind of change. A youth motivated by justice and not a corporate media's interpretation. A youth that sees the beauty in human life and will make it better all through struggle. Thanks.
All right, up next we have Adam Henson from Stanford University.
So I'll introduce myself a little bit, and then I'll outline what I'm going to talk about and then wrap it up. So my name is Adam Hudson. I'm a rising senior at Stanford University. I'm majoring in international relations with a minor in Arabic. And I live in Pittsburgh, California. Grew up there all my life. Went to Pittsburgh High School. Pittsburgh's obviously, I don't know if any of you guys have heard of Pittsburgh, it's a very different environment from Stanford University. So my experience was a little, unique compared to most Stanford students. So I don't know if you guys have any kind of impressions about Stanford students, but what you're going to hear from me is going to be a lot different from what you hear from most Stanford students. So don't take me as like a poster child for what Stanford University is. I'm a horrible advertiser for Stanford University. So what I'm going to talk about first is I'm going to talk about what I think the role of universities and students play in terms of a democratic society and social change in general. And then I'm also going to talk about the reality of what universities are and the way students basically are treated in universities. And just sort of the obstacles we face in furthering social change and creating true democracy and true freedom in this society. And then I'm going to wrap it up. I'm going to talk about what I've been doing at Stanford to basically resist that. So first of all, so universities basically, they're a place of higher learning, critical thought, and free thinking, and critical thinking. And that's a very crucial component of democratic society because obviously, you know, our First Amendment is freedom of speech. How can you exercise free speech when you don't have free thought? So that's very, very critical in a democratic society. And universities are they're probably one of the few places in societies in which there's an open space where everybody goes to learn. And when you learn, you get to ask critical questions, ask deep questions, and further the intellectual horizons of mankind. And by doing that, it can also help further social change as well. Because when you have people questioning what's going on in society, then you begin to have people who actually put those thoughts into real action. And so students, I see, they're agents of learning and social change because they can take what they learn in universities and apply it into the social and political world. So all the stuff you want to learn is, say, like an econ class, not from, like, you know, traditional economics class, but a real, like, economics class in which you get, you know, economic perspectives from capitalism and socialism and anarchism, not just capitalism, and then anarchism and socialism are just seen as like, oh, they don't work, we don't teach those, as if capitalism works. And I'm sure, as you can see from this economic crisis, capitalism really does work, doesn't it? It really works. I'm feeling it. So that's what universities should be, and that's what I think the role of students play in society. But unfortunately, the reality is not like that, because I'm sure I probably don't have to say this to you guys, but we don't really live in a truly democratic society. I mean, if we did, we probably wouldn't be here right now, right? So we don't live in a truly democratic society. So what kind of society do we live in? Is it a socialist society?
No.
Socialism for the rich, maybe, but for everyone else, no. So what kind of society do we live in? I would say we live in a very autocratic capitalist society, in a sense that power and wealth are concentrated within the hands of a few, whereas everybody else, they just get all the crumbs that are kicked under the table. And so that's what I see as in this society, is that it's a very authoritarian capitalistic society. And what role do universities play in that? Well, so since this is a socialism conference, I'll mention a very well-known socialist, Italian socialist, Antonio Gramsci. I'm sure you guys heard of him, right? Mm-hmm. Guy who was imprisoned under Mussolini during the 30s and 40s. He was the one who came with that idea of cultural hegemony. So Marx, he basically saw, as you know, the division between the bourgeoisie and the capitalists, and you know the proletariat and the capitalists, and the, you know, the proletariat selling labor to the capitalists, and we all know what happens next, right? So Gramsci, he said that, like, you know, that's not enough. Capitalist societies have what's called cultural hegemony. There's an ideological framework that justifies that capitalist society, so you don't have to constantly beat people over the head to make them obey you. You just basically brainwash them and make them think, hey, capitalism is freedom. It's compatible with democracy. Hey, as long as you have, like, you know, these Nikes and these all these nice tennis shoes and Hannah Montana, all this stuff, you're free, right? living under the great democracy of Walmart. The wonderful democracy of Walmart and Kmart and Target and every single other corporation in America. That's what, you know, you get. That's the kind of thing you get from our lovely corporate media, Fox News and MSNBC. And so what role do universities play in this? So they're a bought priesthood. So they basically provide the ideological support for that. You know, all the people who, you know, you see on TV and all the experts and academics, they come from places like, particularly like Stanford University, Hoover Institution, Condoleezza Rice, Milton Friedman, you know, Mr. Neoliberal. Yeah, he was a Stanford dude. That guy was Mr., you know, Milton Friedman,
Rumsfeld.
Yep, Rumsfeld, he was at Stanford too. Well, not physically at Stanford. We kind of kicked him out. I can talk more about that. So, yeah, so universities are basically a fraught priesthood. And also, they sort students within their own positions within the class structure. So students who go to, like, community college or state schools, most likely getting within the middle class. Students who go to Harvard and Stanford, power elite. So all these, you know, all those kids at Stanford University and Harvard, you know, they're basically, you know, and I'm speaking from my own experience, that from what I've seen is that basically there's a lot of consultative cultivation that goes within these universities, and they shape you to become a future George Bush or Al Gore, to become one of those people. And so that's why all the people, you know, all the politicians, the business people, that's where they come from. Yale, Princeton, Harvard, all the like people who are on Wall Street, you know, Harvard Business School, Stanford. So that's the reality. So in a sense, students are they really free-thinking individuals? Are they really using their own intellectual pursuits for critical thought and asking deeper questions about society? Not really. It's basically just, long story short, students are treated like sheep. Basically like sheep for an authoritarian capitalist society. And that's the reality that I see. But it doesn't always have to be like that. And there is some autonomy and agency that students have. And as you can see here by these panelists, you know, they haven't succumbed to it. I haven't succumbed to it. We haven't succumbed to it. We have some agency. We don't have to obey by it. We can resist it. We have a choice to resist it. And universities, like I said, they're great places for critical thought and critical thinking. And I've, like, just as a personal aside, like, I've gone to the Stanford Library. There are so many books there. There's so much reading material. There's just everything. And it's all right there. I mean, as long as you have a Stanford ID. I mean, if you don't have a Stanford ID, then it's difficult to get into, which kind of sucks in that respect. But that's what I'm talking about, that when you have universities in which these places are, you get together a community of scholars to basically further knowledge of mankind, that's a great thing for a society. That's why universities should be more free and open and more connected with the real world, instead of just these institutions that sort students within their own position within the class structure and treat them as if they're separate from the real world. That's another issue that another problem that universities face. And that's also apparent at Stanford University whenever the issue of, like, say, Condoleezza Rice comes up. She's a, you know, Hoover Fellow and a faculty member and a prima facie war criminal. But people are like, oh, well, you know, it's not our job to, you know, have an opinion on that. You know, we can't do anything. When it's like, if you ask a really deeper, more critical question, like, well, what does it say if I, as a Stanford student, do not voice my outrage as a human being to these actions she's done? Does that mean I'm legitimizing it? That's a very critical question. But when you're in a university in which they're structured like that, those kinds of questions just get wiped out. They don't really get discussed in the mainstream culture of universities. And so, my time is coming up, so I'll just wrap up a little bit with basically what I just said about universities. Universities, you know, they sort people within the class hierarchy and the capitalist structure of society. And I think the role of students these days is to build a culture of resistance. So what I mean by that is kind of a culture that's the total opposite of what we have now. Not a culture of apathy and mediocrity and conformity, but a culture of resistance in which students constantly resist intellectually, physically, mentally, psychologically, constantly resisting the status quo of society, be it in the universities, their workplaces, wherever. So when it comes, like, at Stanford University, with the presence of Condoleezza Rice, that's why we have a petition going around to hold her accountable and prosecute her for war crimes. And so far, that petition has 1,200 signatures, faculty, students, alumni, community members, etc. You know, so that's one sign of hope, I think, for Stanford University. But we still got to get the ball rolling. We still have a long way to go. But I think the best way for students at universities to create a better society is to, within their universities, create a culture of resistance. And I'll just end it like that.
Speaking of libraries, students at San Francisco State University, we don't have a library. It's under construction and it'll never be finished.
Yeah, it'll be done after I graduate.
Yeah. So, with that note, next I have Wael Alassadi from Portland State University. So, come on up.
Uh,
Like you said, my name is Wael Asadi. I'm from Portland State. And we just recently started, right after the attack on Gaza, we started a student group called Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, which we fictionally call SUPER. we've been really successful. We were able to get people out, and we had three different protests in the Portland area when the assault on Gaza happened. We've been able to hold a Nakba week, and we've been able to, within a six-month span, really create a core of students, as well as work with ISO and different members in the community to create a movement there at Portland State University that's calling out the crimes that Israel is committing against the Palestinian people. What I really want to talk about was not necessarily SUPER, but sort of the opportunities that have come around for the Palestinian justice movement, as well as the obstacles and risks that we face in the coming future, as well as what we need to do to move forward from here. In terms of the opportunities, I think a lot of people probably have noticed that since the attacks on Gaza, since Israel killed 1,400 people, 900 of them citizens, 400 of them children, there's been a huge opportunity in terms of the Palestinian justice movement, because there's been a significant shift in global opinion. Specifically here in the United States, we have a lot of opportunities now. There were protests all over the world, in every single capital, all over the Arab world, and all over the United States as well. More significantly, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the United Nations Human Rights Commission have all come out and condemned Israeli war crimes. And most, I think, Amnesty International, about 3 days ago, came out, said that their investigation is over and that Israel was guilty of war crimes. And those are really significant changes that we have. A lot of people are also noticing on campuses that there has been a shift in perception, whereas the myth that the Israelis were the victims of Palestinian oppression somehow, that myth is beginning to go away. I mean, the bottom line is people, you know, finally believe what they saw on television, that Palestinians were being shot at with phosphorus. And these are really, really great opportunity for us to mobilize activists, mobilize the community, and continue to grow the movement to make sure that Israel abides by international law and ends its apartheid policies. But we also face some risks, and the main risk is a falling into the trap of being a part of, falling into the semantics of the peace process again. We happen to have a president who's a really gifted orator, and who seems to be able to lull people to sleep with language that the peace process is somehow going to move forward. And we can't waste another 8 years on something like the Oslo Accords or something like the roadmap. We have to, for instance, in sort of this change from mobilizing people to this discussion of semantics and how weak Obama argument is we could look at his speech at Cairo. The only thing that he said of substance concerning the Palestinian justice issue was that Israel should stop and freeze its settlements. That's it. And that is below any minimum demands that Palestinians have. Yet that shifted the conversation, not only in the media, but also amongst many activists, as to what is settlements. Is freezing settlements okay? Should settlements be expanding? And it shifted that conversation back to a place where we're talking about subjects that we should be moving forward from. Those are the things that we need to move away from. Israel right now is not politically ready to negotiate. There isn't political pressure from coming in from within the Palestinian territories to bring it to any kind of negotiating table. And I think the best example of that is if we look back at the Intifada. The first Intifada was a situation where you had all the Palestinian society in the West Bank and Gaza, as well as within Israel itself, in the streets, striking completely in civil disobedience. And they had created a real problem for the Israeli government. They couldn't occupy the land anymore. They couldn't occupy the people anymore. And yet, the Oslo Accords were able to, in a huge way, shut down the Intifada. and really slow down what was happening by lulling people into this peace process. And it killed the Intifada, because people thought that they were going to go into these peace negotiations and be able to get their own state somehow. And that's the kind of trap that we can't fall into again. We need to continue to build the movement. We need to continue to support the Palestinian resistance within the West Bank as well as within Gaza. I think what we need to do specifically is to focus on the three sins of Israel all taken together. And that is, first and foremost, is the ethnic cleansing that's going on in Gaza right now. The people in Gaza are trapped in a large open-air prison. The amount of food that's coming in, club people making bread out of animal feed. We have an apartheid situation in the West Bank where people are in Bantustans. They have a very difficult time moving in from one village to another. And the final aspect that people should forget about also is the second-class citizenship that Palestinians face as Israeli citizens. And all three of those things should be fought against. And I think, one of the previous speakers said, we need to support the BDS campaign, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and support the popular grassroots resistance there. There's a lot of resistance that we don't hear about here in the media, in places like Belayin, a little village in the West Bank, places like Na'lin, where every day in, day out, week in and week out, for years now, Palestinians have been going into the streets, along with international activists as well as some Israeli peace activists, and facing off against the Israeli military, facing off against the occupation, being shot at by rubber bullets, tear gas canisters, and sometimes live ammunition as well. But we need to shine light on that resistance. We need to shine light on what's happening there in Belayin and Na'lin, and we need to make sure that people see what's happening there. And we need to support those movements ideologically as well as financially. We also need to support a lot of the movements that are going on. I think George Galloway just did a huge convoy here in the United States where they raised over $100,000 for the people in Gaza, and they're driving from Cairo into Gaza, I think, on July 5th. So activities like that. And then finally, there's a big one that I sort of really just want to, a big event that's coming up that I really hope a lot of people support, and I hope the anti-war network adds to their agenda, which is Norman Finkelstein, if any of you guys know him, former professor from DePaul University, has been organizing with a lot of other groups a big peace march, if you will, from Cairo. It's going to go from Cairo. People are going to walk across the Sinai and break the siege on Gaza on January 1st of 2010. He's hoping that Noam Chomsky and Jimmy Carter will lead this, and they want to get about 5,000 to 10,000 people out there. You guys can find out more about this at Norman Finkelstein's website. It's normangfinkelstein.com, and I think I think they just sent out the email, and they're really going to start promoting this. But we're asking people from every single university to democratically elect one person or multiple people, depending on how much you fundraise, and send them to join this huge contingent of people that are going to walk across, just like Mahatma Gandhi, you know, Salt March, just like the marches during the civil rights era, march from Gaza and break the siege and end that siege. And if we could start there, that would be a really great place to start. So I hope all of you fundraise. We don't want people to have to pay any money for this. Hold fundraisers and send at least one delegate from each university or from each organization that you're with to be a part of this and end the siege on Gaza, because that's the most important thing that we have to do immediately.
So now it's going to be time for questions, comments, whatever you want. So I'm going to limit people to 2 minutes. Just raise your hand if you have a question. Just do a hook. And I'm going to just, if I can't see your name tag or I can't, my eyes aren't that great. I'm just going to describe you by what you're wearing or something like that. All right? So let's start. Russell?
Okay. I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, what we can do concretely, you know, this coming semester, students. One thing that Students Against War has been attempting to do, you know, reaching out a hand to other organizations. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You know, you really have to be the other person take a hand and we have to get together. But so coalition building, I think, is can be very effective, especially when you're trying to build a public event, you know what I mean? I also think that we should, if not already, start trying to find ways that you can contribute more to your school newspaper. Because we were talking about how journalism, the way people get their news, is seriously lacking responsibility and, you know, a good reporting and good analysis. So, I mean, you know, maybe we need to do it ourselves. That gets your school newspaper, and we have a College Not Combat, it's a newsletter we try to put out every month. And so, you know, this coming up, we're going to try to, you know, push that more and try to get more organizations to start contributing to get, you know, a lot stronger, maybe have more than just like 6 pages. I don't know, you know. And yeah, I would like to see, and I hope that we make that resolution this year for Palestinian liberation. I think that's very important. And I've only been working with the camp for a little bit, but I think I'm confident we'll be able to get that passed.
Can I directly respond?
What I'm going to do is I'm going to let a couple people and then I'll send it back to the panel.
Okay, so up next I have Dylan Grace.
Yeah, so hi, my name's Alex. I'm a student at San Francisco State University. I've been going to school there for like 6 years now. You know, working part-time and going to school part-time, it's killer. And the budget cuts are really a big issue on that campus. There's already, you know, actually for semesters now, different political trends have been, you know, trying different, you know, jockeying for leadership of the, you know, there's been a walkout of hundreds of students every semester against the budget cuts for, you know, semesters on end now. It's really a big issue. The California State University system has, of which San Francisco State is a part of, has over 400,000 students. It produces 60% of the state's teachers, 40% of the state's engineers. It's definitely no ivory tower, but like a hulking public institution. And I think that the budget cuts are really bringing the question of it raises the question for us of what is the role of education in a modern economy. I mean, Adam spoke to it a little bit. The role that since World War II, really, the role that scientists and technicians have played in the process of production, the role that sociologists and economists have played in management, in the modern corporation, especially California, the 21st, you know, the way Mike Davis put it last night, the 21st century high-tech economy of California, you know, needs these graduates. So I think, you know, we're in a really scary moment right now. You know, we've gone through like
30 seconds.
Oh shit. we can't get blinded by Arnold in the slash and burn kind of place that we're in right now. The universities in this state are not going to go away, but there's going to be a reorganization of the university system, and Newsom is on the way, Gavin Newsom, and you know he's positioned himself as a champion of gay rights, but he also brought in these multi-billion-dollar biotech companies into Mission Bay, and they're tax-free, I think we should really see him as the representative of the most developed, capitalized firms in the state, you know, biotech, infotech. The way they want to reorganize the university system is to a university system that creates narrow specialists and technicians. And I think we have to actually present an alternative vision for what education could be, which is really, a universal, permanent, and multifaceted education system. It would actually be imperative for a shift to a socialist society in which, you know, we could reduce to a minimum the, you know, manual and routine work, and eliminate the difference between manual and intellectual labor, gradually eliminating developing a fulfilling mixture of labor and leisure, and then actually finally eliminating the difference between the two. Like, that's the role that education could play in the transformation to a socialist society. And we the Newsom and his project, like, that's not actually for granted, right? Like, we can actually propose an alternative. And finally, this is the last thing. I think we actually have to take advantage of the public political platform that the university provides. I want to read a small section.
Okay.
It's a really, really.
Okay. Yeah,
just there's so many people here. Like when I say wrap up, please wrap up. I know we have lots to say, but
we have to be able to use the classroom as a platform.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. All right. Have a nice lecture.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon, good morning. My name is Norma Gallegos. I'm a member of Radical Member of Socialist Feminist Women's Organization. I'm also a union member of OPEIU Local 3. And I'm coming in class solidarity, and I'm really excited about the panel just because it's important to have an inclusive movement on campus so that there's, you know, networking, not just with the young women that said, sorry, I came in when you were speaking about the anti-war movement and how important it is to line up with other groups on campus. And I guess my question is, what do the panelists think about working with employees on campus, such as, I work on a graduate student campus, it's a school of dentistry here in the city. They're kind of elitist, but, you know, like, what sort of things do you see, foresee in your work, you know, also including campus employees and, you know, building that solidarity, what you have to say about the ending project, you know, and building that, so, and also what do you all think about building the leadership of young women of color, and women in general, and young men, of course, so, thank you so much, and that's it.
Okay, I'm going to take one more speaker, and I'm going to have it back to the panel. So up next, I have...
Well, I think that one thing that's interesting about this panel is, I mean, obviously, everybody's coming at it from a whole bunch of different issues. And I think that one of the things that that I've seen happen over the last year, I'm part of Students Against War at San Francisco State as well, is that there's been a lot of build-up on a number of different fronts in a really radical direction, especially budget cuts. And there's a tendency for all of the student activists to look at each other and be like, well, we should probably be in one we should probably be organizing together. There's like the tendency toward multi-issue organizing. It happened at Berkeley, it's happened at San Francisco State, and all over the place. And the thing that's unifying it, obviously, is the primacy of these budget cuts. It's just, you know, it's going to get even more. The deficit continues to balloon, as people know, and they're going to take it out on us. Unless there's some kind of serious fight back. And the question I think we have to be asking is, how can we make the most powerful student? How can we make the student movement more powerful so that it's not just there's a sit-in and then it recedes? Because that's what's happened for semester after semester. We're not able to actually build more power and actually unite things. One thing that tends to happen sometimes is like, everybody gets together, and then people just go work on their own projects anyway, and there's not really shredding. What I think, you know, needs to happen is there needs to be more of a gelling of a real student left that gets together and strategizes. What are we going to take on now? How can we balance taking on the war, rebuilding the anti-war movement, and fighting the budget cuts? And how can we gel that together with politics that is about us transforming the world, changing the system into something that the community needs? And that's something that, you know, in the 60s, if you look at the trajectory of, like, SDS, other radical student movements, it's not just that they became multi-issue and, like, a grab-all for everything, but actually there was a development of radical, you know, and socialist politics within those movements, and that actually made everything that people were fighting around more powerful. So they're able to take on the war. You know, the civil rights movement, obviously was a component of that. The women's movement came out of that. It's like that that kind of unified student left is something that we very much do. And I think that the idea of like having people that are fighting on many fronts, it's we have to find a way to make ourselves more powerful, and that's part of the process, I think.
Okay, I'm gonna have to back to answer the question.
I just want to speak to the workers on campus, and you know, so state has been an interesting experience for me. I guess I came at maybe not such a good time because there have been budget cuts, and then the library I only got to experience for my freshman year, and now it's gone. And so I know that for a fact the workers on campus are experiencing the same shitty SFSU that I am. And as these budget cuts increase, I know they're going to demand more labor of the workers on campus. You know, janitors are stuck cleaning more than they used to. Not only that, but teachers are taking cuts. Teachers are being laid off if they're adjunct lecturers. There's no place for them. If you're not on tenure, you can't teach. Some departments may even be closing at state. For example, the arts. The dance department might need to merge with the theater department. So this creates, like, entire majors are being lost here. With that, I think it's also really important for us to build solidarity with the workers on campus. I'm going to rant on this library thing again. They're being forced not only through
like bad situations, but dangerous situations. OSHA came into SF State and said that the labor conditions were unacceptable. They were forcing workers into a building with one exit, which means if anything were to happen, a collapse, they would be trapped. There's no restrooms in the building. It's just like really unhealthy working conditions that the university is putting its laborers through. So building solidarity with that is obviously going to be a really powerful thing for us, and I hope we can work on that in the future.
I actually want to make an announcement I didn't get to mention earlier, but Stanford Does Not Award, the group that I'm part with, we're actually officially a member of a Campus Anti-Award Network. So I want to tie in what Russell said about the importance of networking and collaborating. I absolutely agree with that, and that's a struggle that we at Stanford have been facing, particularly the anti-war movement in general, because before I got to Stanford, there was no anti-war movement at all. It was pretty much non-existent. We had to start from scratch. So joining CAN, I think will definitely help us a lot in the future. And we're really happy to be working with you guys. I also want to mention, with student journalism. So Stanford, we have there's a Stanford Daily. That's the main campus publication. And there's a Stanford Review, which is the conservative one. Then there's a Stanford Progressive, which is kind of the liberal democratic one. And all of them, I have to say, are steaming piles of donkey shit. They're just fucking horrible. I thought the Progressive was good, but they actually rejected an article from someone in our group because they totally redacted a lot of what he had said, and it was a pretty good article, but they're like, oh, this might be too offensive, blah blah blah, too politically incorrect or whatever. So yeah, they've got on my bad side too. So these three main campus publications are just, they're totally, they just really suck. So I definitely agree that there needs to be alternative student voices on campus. And with the culture at Stanford, it's kind of difficult to do, but I'm sure, hopefully with your help and whatnot, we'll be able to achieve that. And also budget cuts, you guys are facing budget cuts. We're facing budget cuts too. Just because Stanford has, $13 billion in endowments, we're still facing budget cuts. But the thing is there is interesting the way they do is because they're very selective about who's going to feel the pain of budget cuts. It's not usually the people at Hoover or the provost and the president. It's usually the community centers. Those are the ones who are feeling the budget cuts. So the ethnic community centers, for African American students, Latino students, Asian students, Native American students, the women's center, and also the LGBT center. Those are all experiencing budget cuts, and employees may be getting laid off, and students have. That's really riled up a lot of students at Stanford, and students have been sitting in, mouthing off to administrators, which I think is great. It's always a good thing to mouth off to Stanford bureaucrats because most of the time they don't know what the hell they're talking about. But Stanford is very corporate, very non-transparent, very undemocratic. Their whole thing is we know what's best, we see the bigger picture, and they're very reluctant to take in student and worker input, which really sucks because we're the ones feeling the brunt of a lot of these things. So go ahead.
I was going to say along the same lines, I think there's two things that we can do on campuses specifically. I think a lot of the times we don't have to reinvent the wheel completely. There's a lot of networks and resources that are available to students. For instance, at Portland State University, the students from their student fees have $12 million every year that are available to them. Right now they're mostly being used to throw luau parties and Arabian nights with hookah. I mean, that's the kind of money that you can tap into. A student group like us, for instance, Student Center for Palestinian Equal Rights, hopefully next year we'll have a budget of $70,000 to work with. I think a lot of people don't know that that's available to them. We need to tap into those resources. That's how really successful social movements are made, is we need resources. And those resources are available. And we don't live in such an oppressive society that radical movements can't, tap into those resources. So a lot of that is already there. The second aspect of that, it's sort of along the same lines, which is that we need to go back to taking over the governing of our universities ourselves. And the way to do that is to join with the faculty, whose interests are almost the same as student interests. And faculty senates, student senates. We need to take back the government of our universities, and because, like you said, it's become a corporate entity where the administration and the staff are making all the decisions. And in our past in the United States, that hasn't always been the case. Students and faculty have historically been able to really run the universities the way they wanted to, and that's been corroded, and we need to get back to that by engaging in those centers of power.
Okay. All right. Thanks. So I'm gonna. So from now on, I'm just gonna have people questions, comments, and then at the end, each panel member is gonna have come back and say a little thing or two. So up next, I have a question from Duran, and then after Duran, I have Tasha.
Hi, I'm Duran. I'm Sam, friend of the district here, actually. Just real quick, I just wanted to say a few things and then just get to a quick question. I mean, I think that one of the things, and I don't think this is so much so maybe implied, but it is maybe seem like a little bit. I mean, I feel like with the Ivy League schools or schools like Stanford and stuff, there are definitely working class people there. I mean, I know plenty of people who have like $150,000 in loans from going to Stanford and going to like other places. So I just want to point that out, that these schools, it's not just exclusively like rich people that go there. There should be more working class people there, but you know, with the way financial aid works. I think this one thing real quick about like Obama, like I guess some people can consider him as like this great coordinator, this great speaker, but I think also you can see like people are starting to challenge him on so many things. You can look especially specifically like I think the LGBT rights, like fighting for like gay marriage in this country and having it on a national basis. People like 6 months ago would not, like I know back home in D.C. from where I'm from, wouldn't even dare to like totally even say anything about Obama. And back then people were calling me a hater. And now people are like, hell, like I'm pissed off that he basically tried to say for DOMA that like comparing like people that want to have like marriage or equality to saying that there's like comparing it to incest. It's insane. And I think the same thing, like his speech at Notre Dame at, like on abortion rights and basically like cowtailing totally to the right wing, and people in the past that wouldn't have challenged him, but are actually all about like saying something about it, and people are looking for ideas. And I think as students, it's really important like for all of us to actually connect these issues, like including to the anti-war movement. I think one of the questions I do have is like, that was an issue, at least when I went to University of Maryland back east, was like getting students off campuses. And I think it's something that sometimes is a harder thing to do. So I just have a question to the panel, like what are ideas that actually connected within local communities and actually getting more students off and making a connection, because there are so many students who are part of the working class and we shouldn't see it as two separate things.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
And then,
I'm Tasha, I go to PSU, I'm a member of the ISO as well as Super. And yeah, I'm just really excited for the fall. There's a lot of work we have coming up, you know, ahead of us and stuff as far as organizing and building coalition stuff on our campus. But the reality of the budget cuts is really going to hit a lot of students coming in the fall. And it's very easy to make those connections to the war that's going on. You know, like, for instance, on NAPFA week when we did our, we did planning and stuff on campus, like, we tabled and it was very easy to talk to people like how much money that, you know, the Israeli government is getting to kill people, you know, and like build walls and destroy lives and, you know, and that money is going there instead of coming here and building our education or infrastructure stuff in this country and creating jobs for young people and actually, you know, building a society, you know, based on better standards and stuff. So, I mean, I definitely like those. That's what makes me excited about the fall. Like I said, there's still a lot of things. But I think it's also really awesome. People are talking about building the community. It's not just staying on campus. It's not just building and organizing on campus. It's reaching out to the community. And I've been reading Detroit, I Do My Dying, which is an amazing book everyone should pick up and read. But the interesting thing in this book that's really standing out for me is like how the organizers, young workers and stuff, took over the student newspaper at Wayne State University in Detroit and like made it radical. And not only like they made it radical for student newspaper, but they made it reach out to the communities. And actually it was for the communities. It wasn't for on campus. Like students and stuff related to it because of what was going on. But it was for the communities. And it was the thread that connected the community together to, you know, the revolutionary union movements and stuff, the black worker movements, and connected all these communities together, the Arab community, like connected all together, was that student newspaper, which was so influential in building that stable base that's needed. So, I mean, definitely, you know, writing in a newspaper, it's going to be a lot for us to take over a newspaper, but starting to eke our way in there, building with the community, I think is very important, because that's pretty much like a large part of our jobs. Not only are we the future, you know, as far as workers, but we help strain those communities and stuff together. So.
Okay. Hi, I'm Liz, and I'm from Seattle, and I just graduated from UW.
Woo!
And get the hell out there before the budget cut, or before the tuition goes up. But I was thrilled when I got 5,000 free copies. So I can only imagine what you can do with $70,000. Like, holy shit, that is a lot of money. Not anywhere near the president of the university makes. But anyway, so we only have a $9 billion deficit in the state of Washington. And the, I know all of you Californians are jealous, but the UW just received a 25% budget cut for next year. That is one quarter of the university that will no longer be financed and therefore no longer exist in 3 months. And so the way that the university is going to mediate this is they changed the law so that they can raise tuition twice as much as they could legally before. Before this, there were some laws that protected students, and in-state tuition could only go up 7% a year.
30 seconds.
Are you serious? They changed the law so that they could raise it 14%. I need to get back on the list. Okay. And I think that the university's response has been, they purport themselves to be for public education. They work for one of the largest research institutions in the country, but they are privatizers. They don't want to say it, but they are, because they are bringing in the CIA, they're bringing in CIA programs, Microsoft basically owns every fucking library at the University of Washington. The Gates family has two buildings named after it, and Bill Gates' father sits on the Board of Regents at the University of Washington. This is a university that is for sale, whether or not they're willing to say it. And I think that this really raises the question that universities are a microcosm of society. They train people to be workers and are not shy about saying that. And very briefly, the ISO is part of the Against Budget Cuts Coalition, which has done a really great job doing what the sister over there said about uniting students, workers, and faculty against the budget cuts. We were very successful in forcing Mark Emmert, who's the president of the university, who makes $1.3 million a year and lives in a free house provided by us, into a round of town halls. Can I get back on the list? Give me a whirl.
They cut the list because there's so many people up, and right now we're running out of time, and I want to get everyone out on lunch at time, so I'm limiting it to 1 minute. I'm real sorry, but there's so many hands up. So, person in the back.
1 minute.
Yeah, 1 minute, sorry.
First, I think it's important to acknowledge, like, education and war are the main topics here. And I think that's actually where we've seen some of the most consistency between the administrations from Bush to Obama. And I think there's a reason that education and war are some of the main things young workers, students need to be pushing right now. I think historically education reform has been seen as a way to kind of divert attention away from the society's larger social problems. They see, education as connected in the sense that it's building, that it's building young people for the workforce. I think we also need to see it connected, but in a different way, that we want to, use the occupation of our campuses that started happening this year for the first time, and then when we go into the workplace, we have the experience of an occupation, and we need to take that experience into the workplace and build a culture of resistance, both on campuses, but also among young workers, because we're going to need to build a labor movement, because young workers are in some of the worst, dire straits right now.
That's
in all
right.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
I just wanted to say that, like, basically we're all facing budget cuts. The UC Regents are threatening a 25% fee hike, and they're threatening a 4 to 8% pay cut to all the workers on campus. And so we've been working really closely with our unions, and we found that that's definitely a point of strength, and I recommend it to a lot of people. But I'd just like to say that, with this corporate structure that we have in our universities, at our university, we have the head of the poverty center makes $300,000 a year. So every time we come to some sort of like one problem, like budget cuts, or we're investing in countries that are occupying other countries and things like this, we need to, instead of like fighting back and then falling back into a recession, we need to take concrete power, sustainable power, and we need to create a more democratic society within the universities themselves and get ourselves, you know, the people making the decisions so that no longer do we have to fight and we can sustain the progress that we make and no longer fall back. And I propose that the people here maybe meet during lunch just to exchange emails and stuff like that so we can start this now. Mm.
Okay, up next I have Black Abolition Shirt.
My name is Darren from Seattle. We were supposed to have a speaker. James got really sick. He was going to talk about our organizing, so I'll just try in less than a minute to do what he was going to do in 10 minutes. The short of it is just we were able to stop some classes from being cut, and I totally think the question about staff, teachers, students, everybody working together is essential. We had rallies, petitions, grievances, went to the Board of Regents, all that kind of stuff needs to happen. I think it's never over, though. They're now coming back for even more cuts in the fall. So I think the necessity of trying to coordinate between multiple campuses is essential. And then the last thing I'll just say is, it really, you know, for people who aren't in the ISO, yes, it's ultimately a question, the budget cuts. It's about the priorities of the world that we live in. And at some point, we need to broaden it out much bigger and say, what kind of world do we want to live in that deprioritizes education but has hundreds of billions for war and for the bailouts for the rich?
My name is Nina. I'm a recent graduate from University of California, Santa Cruz. And there we have a pretty big radical community. We are also a chapter of CAN, and we work with workers, faculty, the community, and we have a lot of alternative media and resources, but it still isn't enough. And I think it kind of boils down to these identity politics of tactics, basically. And I just kind of want to bring it back to the whole title of this conference, which is building a new left for a new era. So, like, let's try and talk about some of these new tactics that we could use, because I feel like a lot of people don't get active because they don't see the tactics that we use as being effective, like rallying, because we, you know, we go out, we have hundreds, we do walkouts, but it's still not enough, especially in the UC system where there's like 10 campuses. And, you know, the importance of working with other campuses, you know, is something that needs to be reiterated again and again, but, you know, it's not enough. So maybe posing the question to you guys, like, what are some new tactics that we can do for this new year?
All right, thank you.
Hi, my name is Dan, and I'm a recent graduate of Fresno State. The reason I wanted to ask the panel kind of the same question, some kind of insight or whatnot wisdom, is because our campus, actually, the administration faculty actually scared the shit out of the students from doing anything. We have a free speech area, but everybody avoids it just because they already know how everybody feels about it, faculty. Two examples, recently our ASI elections, we had a radical party organized. There had never been parties organized to run as a list or whatnot. And bullshit violations came from left and right, from the actual ASI in governance at the time. So we had to fight a lot. We had to, tempt them with lawsuits for them to, like, take the shit seriously. And we finally got our members on the ASI, so thank God for that. But, for example, we had a public debate about free speech. What kind of free speech is allowed on our campuses?
30 seconds.
Okay. The consensus at the end was they pitted against university speech and Main Street speech. And what they said was, you know, universities were the vehicles for all the scholarly learning and whatnot. So thereby suppressing, you know, non-published authors and leaders and stuff. And the consensus of that actual debate from our faculty was, our university, we're not the place for that. Being Fresno and whatnot, no, we can't do that. So I just wanted some insight on that, too.
I'm from UC Santa Cruz also. Woo. at our campus, we're also facing pretty tremendous budget cuts, and kind of going into the cultural resistance thing, like early in the 70s, there was a tremendous movement at UC Santa Cruz that was able to wrest significant concessions from the bureaucratic administration, but they're using the opportunity of these budget cuts to sort of perform a coup de grace on the last of what's left of the progressive movements that we have. And so if there is a there's a great need for me to finish this really quickly. There's a great need for us to, like, build a large sort of national organization, or with the University of California system, California-wide, struggle to be able to take it to them as well. And there's a great, like, case in need to do that quickly, because they're trying to obliterate what's left of the left and kick the left off of the University of California campus. I'd plug a pamphlet by Hal Draper, The Mind of Clark Kerr, which was written in the 60s during the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, and it's, I think, very relevant to the struggle we're going through today.
My name is Steve, and I'm from Seattle, too, and I want to take up a little bit where Liz left off about the Anti-Budget Cut Coalition. One thing that they're doing at the University of Washington is they're trying to come up with a, quote, new model of funding. In other words, they want to privatize the university. Right now, only 16% of the University of Washington is funded by the state of Washington. The rest of it comes from grants and so forth. One thing the Anti-Budget Cuts Coalition did that was really good was unite faculty, staff, and students. We're very, very active around the fight around the janitors who are having their budget cuts, who are having their shifts cut back and so forth and laid off. And that's been a real good unifying point. I think one thing that we really need to stress and that people need to get across and win the debate is that this is not a natural disaster. This is not something coming down from the skies. This is a human-made thing. This is created by this economic system, and we have to get beyond that. We can't allow ourselves to be limited by what they say is available and the resources. Military has been raised, the tax structure, all that kind of stuff, and that needs to be stressed very, very hard, that this is not a natural disaster, that we can fight it, that the resources are there to win.
Yeah.
Okay.
Started off the janitors union, if you're actually part of ASME, they actually had a really long struggle at UC Santa Cruz for a really long time. And the students actually were really involved in that struggle. And they actually eventually did win a reasonably fair contract in the end, just this past week. But then they had this huge wave of budget cuts that came up. And what ended up happening is the workers then stood with the students when they started to protest the budget cuts and our tuition hikes. And so now, I mean, we have to support each other. So, if the students are going to stand with the workers are going to stand with the students, and we all have to get together because ultimately we have the same goals on our campuses and in our communities, because, the students and the workers are still living in the same place, even in the broader context of the city, especially university-centric cities like UC Santa Cruz, where the community thing.
Hi, I'm Nick from Berkeley. I'm a member of the ISL, and I've been involved in Take Back Berkeley with Andy. I just wanted to very quickly just come off the back of something Adam said about the role of universities. Berkeley and the UC system generally has been involved in the construction of every nuclear weapon that's in the US arsenal through its management of the Los Alamos lab and the Livermore lab. And some of the experimental weapons that the Israelis dropped on Gaza were also developed in those labs. So not only are universities there to provide ideological justification for imperialism, but actually constructing tools that imperialism is using to extend imperial control in the Middle East. But just very quickly, I wanted to speak to the question that other people have spoken to really well about students and workers working together. I think it's not just a bonus for us to do that, it's absolutely essential to do that. Because if we don't do that, they're going to use that against us. They're going to use those divisions against us. And we're already seeing that on our campuses, the ways that students are being told if workers get raises, then that means it's going to come out of your tuition and we're not going to be able to pay for more books. And similarly, workers are being told that unless we impose fee hikes, then we can't pay for higher wages for you. So we've got to work together if we want to avoid those kind of divisions being used against us.
Thank you. Okay, so we have Laura and then Brian, and I'm cutting off Liz because we're going back to the panel, so that's what's all left, so go ahead.
Yeah, I just graduated from Cal State Long Beach. I've been organizing on campuses for like 5 years or whatever, so I'm hearing everybody talk about, obviously the budget cuts right now is the the instant, you know, we got to get to it, we got to get it done. But I think we have a panelist who talked about, you know, immigrant students and their struggle.
Right.
And I haven't heard one question or one comment regarded to the issue. I think that just like, you know, Nick said right now, like workers and students, it's essential. It's not like if we get to it. And I think that that's something that has to be done with the immigrant rights movement right now, too. I don't see much of like the student groups or even like the left, honestly, even addressing what the immigrant struggle is right now. And that needs to happen, because if it doesn't, if students who are citizens, you know, can get financial aid but that's getting cut, just imagine what an undocumented student goes through every day. And those workers that aren't on their campuses, they might be undocumented too. So my question to the panel is actually, what are you guys doing, you know, on your own respective campuses to hook up with all these different, obviously you all represent different issues. What are you doing to connect? Because if we don't connect, we're not going to go anywhere.
Last
week,
Brian, and back to the panel.
So I'm Brian. I'm actually a product of all three school systems in California, the CSU, UC, and I guess the public ones, and also community colleges. Right now I work at City College in San Francisco. And one thing that's interesting about what's happening with the cuts right now in California is that it is affecting, and I'm talking about the schools, it's affecting everybody in the schools. We're talking about the staff, where we're, you know, being asked to take pay cuts, furlough days, the teachers, they're being laid off, and students, we see what's happening. In my school, And also, we're seeing a political opening as well, with people questioning the very basis of our society, neoliberalism, you know, being washed away. People are seeing billions of dollars going to the war, or billions of dollars going for bailouts. Let me just list a couple of things. Cutting 60% from disabled students' programs, from immigrant services for students, who get help for welfare and stuff like that. All this money going to the war, and the chancellor is saying, pay $6,000 and you can sponsor a course so it doesn't get cut. There's these tremendous cracks right now in the ideology that the money doesn't exist. And unfortunately, a lot of the leadership, I'd say, of some of the unions, some of them, is saying, maybe that's right. Maybe we have to take some cuts right now. I think it's a goal of students right now, teachers who are willing to stand up against that, staff who are willing to stand up against that, and actually expose those cracks. You know, take a crowbar and open it up and say, you know what, the money exists. Prop 13, what about Prop 13? What about all the money that all the rich people in California, all the corporations are paying that used to be able, that made it so our schools could be free? And I think we need to be able to, you know, grassroots action, workers and students together to challenge, and we also need to bring up these social justice issues as well. It's going to be important in building the coalitions we need to be able to make this successful. And I think we can use that power to pressure also some of the leadership that I think can be pressured into taking a better stance.
All right, so clearly, like, we don't have enough time for everyone to talk, but, like, we have the weekend, so meet up with people, keep this discussion going. We should exchange information and really get hooked up and start, like, really working towards what we want. So I'm going to go back to the panel. So I'm just going to go in the order that they spoke, so go ahead, you have 3 minutes.
Okay. I just want to say, you know, one thing that Laura mentioned, we actually work with, like, the largest immigrant rights organization right now, which is pretty much like the Dream Network. But the Dream Network, they're major, major advocates of the Dream Act. So we try to, you know, help talk to them and even engage in discussions or maybe even debate on what the Dream Act really is. And because right now, like Laura mentioned, you know, that even like with AB 540 students, there are very, very, very few scholarships that are available to help students go through college. But even with those scholarships, you know, immigrants have to literally compete for these scholarships. And, you know, most of the time, nobody gets one. So, you know, I just think that as students, we really need to stick together in order to obtain the society that we need. So, you know, it's important to broaden all these movements and work around our common grievances, like the budget cuts. Because that obviously affects everyone. So, yeah, so just connecting it with immigrant rights, anti-war movement, and gay rights, and many other social movements that we need. Thank you.
So I want to talk about the
issues of free speech that you were saying you had problems with in Fresno. And while San Francisco is often viewed as like a really liberal place, we've experienced some of the similar things like that. Actually, when they started this semester, they tried to say that our free speech zone of Mahmoud's Plaza was not allowed to have certain noise elevations, so we couldn't have amplified sound. And they said they were going to test decibel levels to make sure it wasn't too loud for other buildings and all these sort of scientific and bureaucratic bullshit that they're going to put us through and not let us use our free speech center. Meanwhile, the library construction is at huge decibels right next to it. So you can see the hypocrisy there. And eventually it took the BSU, the Black Student Union at State, just taking it over and saying, like, no, we're going to use this space. This is our space, and it's our right to use it. So I know that it's really difficult when they're threatening you, and it just takes taking it back over, because we do need to have agency for our free speech, and it's our right to be able to say this. This is a university where we're learning, we're deforming our own opinions and formulating our ideas, and we need to be able to express them. And then as for new tactics, I think I liked what Nihar, I think, said earlier about changing the way that the education system works. And maybe we don't need to, while teachers are really important and can give us a lot, maybe we should start relying on each other a little bit more and relying upon formulating our own opinions, having conversations, working with people in coalitions, and forming those within our campuses, because we have a lot to teach each other. We have a lot of experiences to share. And as you were saying before, you know, like, imagine what an undocumented student goes through. I would love to be able to hear that and understand that and work with Solidarity to make something better for them. And then finally, I want to finish up with saying, you know, I agree that we need to build solidarity within our community and that the university should be reaching beyond your campus. And I think that we can build this kind of a relationship with our community because we're all feeling the pressures of this economic situation. You know, so many people here raise questions about budget cuts, and I think that it's not just the university that feels that, it's the whole city, it's our whole country right now. We're going through a lot of this stuff, and we need to build that culture of resistance under these circumstances.
All right, cool. Well, I'll repeat the title of this panel thing, because I think it kind of goes to like a lot of the issues that are being discussed. So, I mean, the title is, you know, Students, Young Workers, and Capitalism: How Can We Get the Future We Want? And so, and I think that really sums up, like, I mean, a lot of the things I feel and I agree with, and I think a lot of stuff that's been mentioned so far. Like, you know, it's not just, you know, students that are feeling the cuts. It's also workers, faculty, you know, undocumented students. Like, I actually have a friend. I didn't know this, but I have a friend who I went to high school with at Pittsburgh High. I ran cross country and track with him. I knew him he's a year younger than me. So he was a freshman. I was a sophomore. So I'd known him for like 3 years. And he goes to Santa Clara University. He's an undocumented student. I didn't know that until like someone had told me like a couple years afterwards. And so like. So, like, yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, what you were saying about, like, you know, struggles that undocumented students face, you know, I mean, I never got to talk to them personally, but I do definitely agree that, like, yeah, like, we should be working in solidarity with them. And also not just, you know, immigrants, but also, like, you know, workers, people of color, poor people. Because I think, like, you know, one mistake I think that particularly was made with, like, particularly the liberal left is, like, they fight a lot for, like, working class rights, but a lot of them don't really have the experience of what it is to live working class or live, like, you know, be like a person of color. It's usually like, you know, I care about poor people, but it's usually like, you know, some, usually an upper middle class white person who will say it. Like, it's like, you know, that's cool that they sympathize and they empathize, but I also want to see like Latino students, poor students, Black students, you know, Filipino students that are actually feeling the repercussions of these policies, speaking up for themselves and their communities. And as a person, you know, someone who grew up in Pittsburgh, a very working class, ghetto community, a person, you know, African American male. I mean, I definitely that's one kind of principle I really take to heart. So like your question, was like, what are we doing? I'll mention a couple of things that I want to mention a little bit earlier. Like, there's this thing called Stanford Status Up, which actually inspired what's going on at Berkeley with Berkeley, Take Back Berkeley, like. We're getting all these different causes, like, you know, the anti-war movement and its demand to prosecute Condoleezza Rice with, you know, the demands of the labor community and immigrants' rights. And that demand was won before we drafted our mission statement. So it kind of sucks that we couldn't, you know, take credit for that success. you know, after the mission statement. But yeah, President Hennessy of Stanford University endorsed the DREAM Act. So that's one thing that we're really trying to do is like try to get together all these, you know, basic demands of students, workers, faculty members, because, you know, these universities are not just students, you know, we're a community of, you know, workers, students, faculty members. We got to work together, not just within the universities, but also outside of universities to fight for, you know, a much better future. Because, I mean, the reality is we're all in the same boat. And I think when you have these kind of like labels like, I'm a student, I'm going to fight for students' rights, I'm a black person, I'm going to fight for black rights, I'm a worker, I'm going to fight for workers' rights, I think you're minimalizing the kind of success and the kind of future that you can win. When you put yourself in a larger context of general humanity, like, my thing is, you know what, I'm a human being and I want freedom here. Like, that's the way I see it. I fight for human rights because human rights protect everyone. And so I think we have to transcend these kind of like, you know, these sort of like, you know, minimalized community, not just fight for just one community, but fight for humanity as a whole.
Talked about a lot of things, so I just want to remind everybody sort of what I said about the big march, January 1st, 2010, from Cairo to Gaza. We're hoping to get 5,000 to 10,000 people there, going to the border and walking through the border and breaking the siege on Gaza. If they shoot at people, they're going to have to do it on live television in front of millions of people watching. I don't think they will. I think you can break the siege. So I hope, if some of you guys do work on Palestinian justice issues, please do that. If you don't, go back to your universities and let those people know who work on those issues about this. But on a more general note, I just want to give an example of something that we've been doing at PSU that's been working. Our student newspaper, The Vanguard, which is a really bad newspaper. It's called The Vanguard, too, yeah. They wrote an article about an event that we did calling it anti-Semitic and that we were calling Jews Christ killers. Completely unfounded. It was absolute smear campaign. Because two of the members of Super were student senators, had participated in student government, we were able to speak to the president of the student body, get him in a meeting. They weren't they weren't allowing us to respond in the Vanguard either to these smears to say that this was complete crap and lies. But we were able to meet with the administration, get pressure in from the community, and force them to put in our response. On top of that, what we've been able to do with the Student Senate is now, the Student Senate wasn't meeting with the Faculty Senate. They weren't meeting with faculties. We're hoping that they're going to have a monthly meeting with the Faculty Senate now as well. We want to bring in union leaders to come speak at every, quarterly at every Student Senate meeting and whatnot. Reach out to the anti-war movement. So I think there's a lot of leadership, that there's a vacuum of leadership at a lot of universities that I think we need to engage with.
Sorry.